Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to Enterprise Linux Security. And yet again, I'm here, as always, with Zhao. How you doing?
All good, Jay. As usual, it's a pleasure to be here with you. And we have a really nice show today.
Yes, episode number 18. It's technically, at least in the United States, I think it's probably similar in other countries. It's technically a legal adult now.
Yeah, you can go out and drink.
Wow.
so... over here you can. Just a quick update on the last episode. There was sent out when I was explaining that Lux vulnerability, and I got it wrong at the time. So the vulnerability happens because the passphrase that Lux asks the user when trying to decrypt the volume is not actually the passphrase for the certificate or for the private key that decrypts the volume. It's just a way to authenticate the user with Lux so that Lux knows that that user can access the private key. Lux has access to that private key at any time. So the actual flaw happens because through that online re-encryption, it's possible to trick Lux into starting the de-encryption without asking for the key. So it will immediately trust the user to start that process without asking for confirmation and without asking for that private key. But at no point is the symmetric encryption broken. That was just my misunderstanding of the vulnerability.
Ah, that's an important aside there. That there's a lot to these vulnerabilities and in the order of operations and how to get through the technology. And kind of wonder what it was like to find the vulnerability. You know, how much work it, you know,
it's like hoops you have to jump through.
Yeah, like remember that Grub vulnerability where you press enter a bunch of times if you have a password during the boot process?
And it lets you in.
And it lets you in. It's like, did somebody just sit there in front of a server, like plug in a keyboard and like just mash the enter button? Oh, I wonder what happens if I just press the enter button a bunch of times and then, whoa, oh my gosh, I got through.
Or similar to that, you could crash Fedora just by pressing the key on the console for a minute or two. You would crash it. You would waste the buffer inside it and it would crash. I don't know how many years ago, but yeah.
I wonder how many of these people nowadays that find these vulnerabilities were like, you know, gamers back in the day with like NES and SNES, finding these weird bypasses like the Minus World and Mario. You go at an angle and just the right way, you go right through a wall and then you end up doing some kind of overflow that gets you into a glitched level. And then they, you know, they're teenagers at the time, then they grow up and next thing you know, they're finding Grub vulnerabilities.
Or if you're a PC gamer and you don't like the console plebs, like the Cal level in Diablo, for example, which was tricky also to get to. Yeah. And guess what those people have, what that people has right now? Lots of spare time at home. So yeah, they have lots of time to try these things out.
Yeah, they're definitely very smart people for sure. So the main topic that we're going to talk about today is zero trust security. But before we get to that, we have a vulnerability that we would like to discuss first.
Yeah. So 2022 is starting great, like last year ended.
Oh, boy.
So this week, the vulnerability du jour is Samba with the new disclosed vulnerability. And this is a remotely exploitable one. So it's especially tricky. Apparently, it's possible to trick Samba through some memory corruption that you can trigger it remotely into running whatever code you want. So yeah, it's pretty bad. Log4j showed us just how bad that type of vulnerabilities can be. And apparently Samba has one as well. This one is particularly interesting because of the score, the CVSS score that Red Hat assigned it. They gave it a 9.9, which is just shy of the maximum 10 there. So this is critical nuclear meltdown level here.
Wow.
It's not immediately apparent why, because the bug is in a plugin for Samba. It's in the AFS support, the Apple file system support for Samba, which basically adds extended attributes for files that are shared through Samba. And that's not something that's very common. At least in my experience, I'd never even seen or configured this plugin before. I don't know if you have.
No, I've never even heard of this before today. But then again, to be fair, I've only learned enough Samba to do like tutorials on the YouTube channel. I don't use Samba much because I'm like mostly all Linux. Like I'm all Linux, but you know, there's other things in the house. I don't really have much of a need for this? Because usually people use Samba or CIFS as a means of cross-platform file sharing between, you know, Mac, Windows, and Linux. If you're all Linux, you'll probably use something like NFS because it's exactly. all the same and there's no reason not to. But if you have like a mixed environment, which is really common, then that's where Samba is used more often. So even though I haven't had a use case for this, I'm sure that a lot of people have.
No, personally, I didn't have it either. And I also experienced a lot of cross-system configuration and cross-system play here, but I never got to use this plugin. But apparently there is this flaw in this plugin. You can actually avoid the risk of this by removing fruit from the option VFS objects that's present in smb.conf. So remove fruit from VFS objects in smb.conf, and you won't be vulnerable to this. But you will also lose the functionality that it provides, obviously. So if you have Mac clients that are trying to access the Samba shares, they might not experience the shares in the way that they should. They might see them as empty. Depending on your use case, you may or may not want to do that. It's not immediately apparent why Red Hat assigned it such a high note to this. Again, it's not something that's very common on the average server that's running Samba, but it is present on NAS devices. Stuff like TrueNAS, for example, brings this. And be on the lookout for patches to Samba. There are several versions that are affected, but it is. Be on the lookout for patches that you should deploy. And there might be some new information regarding this vulnerability coming in the next few days that might help us in understanding why it got such a high note from Red Hat.
I do have a feeling that there's more to it. Yeah. Now, on my end, when I configure Samba, I don't know how many people do it the same way as me, but, you know, and I'm sure you know this, you install Samba, you get like this massive, you know, config file that has like all these different settings. I don't know how big it is. It could be hundreds of lines. I don't remember. And then you just, you know, configure it as you need. What I do is I just, I back up that file, but then I just create my own file from scratch containing only the lines of code that I absolutely need for Samba to do what I need it to do. And I do remember trying, because at one point I did a review on an M1 Mac. excuse me. I remember trying to see if the Mac could access the share, and it could. There was no problem there. So I didn't have this option in the file because all I did was just add the ones I absolutely needed, which was not this. So I also kind of wonder if this is like a default somewhere. If you don't, you know, explicitly say you don't want it, I wonder if it could be a default in some versions.
I don't know. If the workaround is removing that option from the config file, it must be explicitly set there for you to be able to remove it. So
yeah, that's true.
There might be some environment that brings this as default. I'm not aware which one it is, if any, but I know that NAS devices do have this option configured because they may be used with iOS devices and Mac and whatever. But again, on your average server running Linux on a company or whatever, this shouldn't be there by default. Unless, of course, you have a Mac-heavy environment, which is not my experience.
Yeah, that makes sense. So also, since you mentioned TrueNAS, they apparently have patched this already. So if you're running TrueNAS, go get your update. I believe it's update 8. I think I lost the page, so don't quote me on that. But it's like as of recording day, I think it was like yesterday or so that it came out. So it was relatively recent. So if you're running TrueNAS and this is something that you use, then, you know, obviously install the patch or whatever system you're using, install the patch.
Yeah. And since it affects NAS devices, for some of them, you'll actually have to wait for firmware updates because you won't be able to directly update this on the device until you have that firmware update. So that might take some time to get out because it has to be tested and all that. So you might just want to look at the options on the smb.conf file and see if fruit is there and remove it just to be safe.
And I thought fruit was healthy. Like I suppose, you know, like nature's candy is supposed to be good for you, but apparently
apples
not.
Are a bit different.
That's true. Apples can give you indigestion if you have too many.
Yeah.
Oh boy. All right. So I think we might be ready to talk about zero trust security, unless we have anything else to point about this vulnerability, because we'll have the information in the description.
Yeah. this was just relevant because of that high note that it got, and we should get awareness of the vulnerability like this out as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. Because if this turns out to have some more use cases that are not apparent, people should be aware of this and mm-hmm. be on the lookout for that information.
So, yeah, I totally agree. So growing up, you know, and it's still the case now, my favorite TV show, my favorite sci-fi show is The X-Files. And the main thing there, and I think you already know where I'm going with this, is trust no one. You know, it's right there in the beginning sequence of every episode. It says, trust no one. Yep. And I didn't know at the time when I was a young teenager watching this show that trust no one would be a big part of my career. So I'm not an FBI agent, though.
It's actually not at the start of every single episode. I believe there are two episodes where they changed that tagline just to go with the story. Yeah, that was an aside.
Easter egg. Yeah. You're familiar. Some of those Easter eggs that they throw in there. I think it was actually more than twice. I think there's like a handful of those where they just change it up on you. Like, what did it just say? Let me rewind it.
It's that moments that you have to freeze frame to make sure that you got it right. But yeah, yep. I believe there were a few episodes where that was changed.
Yep. And now we have zero trust security, which is shifting gears because this isn't about a vulnerability. It's just a style. It's a policy.
It's a policy. It's an architecture. It's a way to look at cybersecurity. And let's rewind a bit so that we start more or less on the same ground. Nowadays, the way that security is handled on a company level is that you usually have your systems segregated. You have your core systems on a different VLANs, on a different network segment. You have your desktops and you have your users and all that residing on a different one. You have systems that are exposed to the outside on a DMZ. You have these different segments. But inside of those segments, the systems are basically equal. So if you trust one, you trust the other one, and they can talk to each other on each of those segments without basically any restrictions because they won't go through a firewall. And zero trust is a different way of looking at that. You basically don't trust the system just because it resides on a specific segment of the network. Each communication, each user, whenever it's talking to a different system, has to provide authentication, has to make sure that it's trustworthy so that the connection is accepted. And that's a different way of looking at security. You're no longer just trusting because of the location of a system. You're actually trusting a system because of its own merits.
Yeah, and that is kind of surprising to me that it isn't more common than it is because, I mean, the more you think about it, the more you realize how easy it is for something to just show up on your network, right? You don't know what it is. You got to figure out what it is. Even in IT environments and in home situations, you might not want to give the Wi-Fi password out, but you type it in for them. It doesn't matter anymore because anyone can just go in the settings of their device and show the password. So then they know what the password is. And if they want to add another device, they just, you know, put that password in on the other device and they can add whatever they want. And obviously that's if you're in person. It's quite different if you're remote. And even here in this house right now, there's literally a rogue Android phone that I'm trying to find because I'm not even kidding you. Like, I've blocked it so it can't communicate with anything. But it shows up trying to get an IP address again, even though now it can't. And it's like, I know one of the kids brought in an Android phone. Let's be honest. That's exactly what it is. But for now, it's disabled. And it's just, if a 13-year-old can do it, I mean, come on, right? Anyone can add anything to the network. But in a business, though, it just surprises me that by default, we're still trusting everything if it's on the correct subnet. That doesn't sound like a good idea.
Yeah. Are you sure it's a phone? Can't it be Android Car or some Android Auto or something like that, or the TV that's running Android?
I thought about that, but it doesn't seem, the MAC address doesn't seem to match, and it actually, there's like nothing running Android, so not even the car is connected to the Wi-Fi, so weird. The only thing I could think of is it could be an Internet of Things device that's using Android as its chipset or some kind of embedded Android thing could be definitely the case.
Yeah. And it's interesting to bring up both the phones and the IoT devices because those are some of the driving forces behind this change of mindset. Mm-hmm. When you have devices that can just be brought into the environment and connect to the Wi-Fi network, or just plug into a free Ethernet jack in the wall at some place in the network, you really need to look for different ways to secure your environment. If somebody can just plug out a PC that's connected to the wall and plug in, a dumb hub or something like that, and just split that port, he just multiplied the ports and he can connect more devices. The PC might still be there, but he might have also connected the Raspberry Pi. He might have connected a laptop that he brought from home. He might have connected some other insecure device. Or worse yet, he might have connected something that's infected with ransomware that can now access other devices on that network segment. And that's really bad for the enterprise. You really do not want rogue devices connecting like that. So a zero trust look at cybersecurity is basically a set of policies and a set of decisions that are made at the company level that serve as guidelines to this. First, you might impose a no bring your own device, or if you bring your own device, you cannot connect it directly to the company Wi-Fi network. You have to use a guest network, for example, that's completely segregated. Or even further, if you do connect it to the network, you have to use something called the health attestation, a security health attestation for the device. It's appropriate at the times that we're living that even the devices have to provide certificates of health, but still. And that will show the network and the systems in the network that this device has been patched, it's not rooted, it's not running anything weird, and it's safe to allow it on the network. And there are protocols to use here to provide that attestation. Curiously, Microsoft has been on the forefront for this, and they have been doing this for years now with their endpoint protection and Intune and lots of other tools that they have. They have been bringing this up. On the Linux side, there are also some efforts on this. And if you are interested in going deeper into the rabbit hole, just Google for Linux hardware root of security. Let me just make sure that I'm not giving you the wrong guidance there. Yeah, root of trust. If you Google for Linux hardware root of trust, you'll find lots of sources about the ways that Linux is also taking steps in this direction, and the software that's being used for this to provide attestation for devices and ensuring that the device is what it claims to be. Because one of the issues here is that whenever you have a software running on a device and you ask, okay, is that device safe? And that software, however much you trust it, is only software. So it can be faked, it can be forged, the reply can be forged. So there has to be some way to harden that requirement. And the hardware root of trust is basically a TPM chip, for example. There was lots of complaints when Microsoft introduced TPM 2.0 as a requirement for Windows 11 recently. And I understand the outcry there, but it does provide this. It's a way to have some functions reside on that chip that's supposedly inviolable. That you can't mess with, sorry for that, that you cannot mess with, and have that be trusted by other systems. It's not infallible. If you have enough resources and knowledge and all that, you might be able to pull that chip off or something like that. There is no foolproof way of assuring this, but it's a step in the right direction. And yep. We'll go through the other ways that zero trust security helps you in a minute.
Yeah, I think I want to take a moment to kind of just make sure the audience understands how big of a problem this is. Yeah. Because depending on the context, you could think of this as a big problem or a little problem. It's always a big problem. And if it's not a big problem right now, it will be, because I've seen all the sides of this. So it was earlier in my career, probably just over a decade and a half ago, I don't even know how long ago, the Conficker worm was the thing that people mm-hmm. were dealing with. And the company I was working for at the time, it was like one of the worst 2 weeks of my career because of how hard I had to work. And it started when an outside employee, a salesperson, used their computer for, you know, God knows what, over the weekend. And then, of course, they go to a location, you know, because there was locations all over the United States, and any one of those locations you could plug in and work. So the person did that. And right after he plugged in the computer, that thing spread like crazy. And it was so hard to contain it too. And that's just, I mean, that's before the pandemic, way before that. That's before the whole work at home movement, when that was really, really new. And there's still a lot of stigma about working from home. And now, you know, work from home is very popular and you have bring your own device. Some companies do that. Even the companies that don't, they often give admin rights to the person that is using the computer so they can install whatever. And of course, malware has access to the same access as the user. And of course, worms want to spread and, you know, connect their VPN into a network. And this has happened. I forgot what the company was, but it was in the news where I think it was a managed service provider, but I could be wrong on that. They had someone connected to a computer from home VPN, and that thing wreaked havoc on everything when it connected in. So right now I kind of feel like every company has to, I'm not saying they have to adopt this, but they should at least look at it, but they really have to know what they're going to do or how they're going to handle ensuring that nothing extra comes along for the ride when one of their employees connects to do their work for the day.
Yeah. If you're running a Linux-only environment, and some companies are, you can look at Radius for the Wi-Fi authentication. It has some mechanisms in place to assure that the device is at least offering some guarantees, some assurances of safety. It's not perfect, but it has the ability to pass those requests along to other servers and other services that can attest that. So Radius is a good option there for Linux-only systems. And we're talking just about regular enterprises that have their desktop systems and their servers and all that, and their segmented network. But there are other concerns here. What about industrial networks where you have the assembly line that's running robots and sensors and all that connected by IP to the network, all running on the same segment? And there are a few available ports out there just on the factory floor in case somebody needs to plug in new equipment. If somebody else gets rogue equipment connected there, gets a rogue laptop or something like that, they can interfere with production. There's people that can get hurt because of that. There's actual physical harm that can come from that. So you really need to make sure that nothing can use those ports and maybe even not have extra ports available or just don't have them connected on the switch on the other side.
Yeah, we don't want a Cylon invasion. we don't want to create actual Cylons. That, you know, how that went in Battlestar Galactica. That's not a good thing.
But this is a real risk for industrial concerns and industrial companies, because securing the network means more than it does for the regular company that doesn't deal with industrial, I don't know, production and assembly lines and whatever. There are additional layers there. So, zero trust is really, really a good idea if you're on an environment like that, and you should use it. And maybe not implement it from one day to the next, because this doesn't happen like that. It takes effort and it takes a lot of planning and all that. But you should at least consider the steps that are necessary to achieve this and start as soon as possible with whatever is possible to be achieved at that moment. And just plan your way into the future. For example, when you're looking at upgrading the existing systems and the existing network equipment, make sure they have the right features to ensure that you can provide zero trust to the rest of the network.
Yeah, I would also say if you're managing an IT network for a medical company, you should really be paying attention, because that is, you know, just like the assembly line example, this could cause harm.
Yeah, absolutely. There are lots of specific use cases here that could benefit from zero trust. And up to now, at least most of it, of course, there are always exceptions and there are always places where they have this type of policies in place. You can look for the alphabet agencies, for example, the security agencies. I'm sure they have features in place that provide them zero trust and even further than that, but still. The majority of companies, the majority of environments do not apply this type of security requirements. And over the years, we've seen CVEs appear more and more. 2022 is a prime example of that, the way that this has been going since Log4j, for example. Mm-hmm. Having rogue devices on your network that you cannot assure they are up to date is a sure way of getting hacked and getting exploited. So you really should not allow that.
Right.
But there are several layers to zero trust security model. And we can go over a few of them. Mm-hmm. Initially, you should have a single and strong source of user identity, a centralized identity management system. What this means here is that, for example, you should avoid situations where your applications rely on, say, Google Authentication, and then you have local users, and then there's a database somewhere that matches one to the other to see if that user has privileges to access a setting or a system or an application or whatever, because then that database is the failure point there, and you don't need that association. You either rely on Google Authentication for everything, or you rely on your own authentication provider, and you should avoid that mismatch. And again, you should try to forego just simple username and password authentication. You should go for a multi-factor wherever possible, through, for example, YubiKeys or through authentication tokens, which are a pretty good way of doing authentication, where you can immediately avoid that issue of reusing passwords and users on different systems. You provide an authentication token for which each application, each system, and if one gets compromised, it doesn't affect the others, for example.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
And then we also have machine authentication as well.
Yeah exactly. That's to avoid having one system being hacked and replaced by another under an attacker control and then trying to impersonate the first one. In this case, you would have a centralized repository of certificates, for example, that identify each of the machines. In a way, this is what Microsoft does with Active Directory. They do have authentication for each of the clients. That's why when a client, for example, gets re-imaged, the authentication, the Active Directory server will complain that it doesn't recognize it, so it has to be re-added to the domain and all that. But this is also possible to achieve on Linux. You can look at Kerberos, for example. And for example, when you use SSH to connect to a server, on the first connection to a different server, you will get this prompt on whatever client you're using. Do you trust this certificate? Do you trust the key that is presented to you from the remote server? It shouldn't be asked to the user. It shouldn't be up to the user to decide if it trusts it or not. There should be a centralized repository of those certificates. And if it's not there, then the user doesn't get the option to say yes, for example, because that would break the trust.
I sure would. Yeah.
Yeah. And that would lead the way to someone maliciously replacing an IP or adding a device to the network and tricking users into logging into it. If it's not in the repository, it's not trusted, it shouldn't be logged into.
Yep.
Next, we have, for example, policies on health of the devices. This can include anything from making sure that the devices that connect to the network have all the updates, are running an antivirus, have specific settings in place, like a firewall in place and active, having the antivirus running, not having any malicious software. You usually do that through indicators of compromise, not having any indicators of compromise active on the system when it logs in. And there are ways to ensure this. When I mentioned TPM before, there are software solutions out there that can rely on TPM functions to ensure their own security and provide that security to a centralized server in order to ensure that both they are who they say they are and the system is safe from those threats. And there are ways to certify that. And that would at least prevent the most obvious attacks, like bringing an infected device into the network, like we discussed before. If you have a Samsung phone, for example, you have a feature on the latest models called Samsung Knox. And that's precisely that. That's a security feature like this that ensures that the device has not been rooted. So it only has the applications that are authorized by Google or whatever store you're using at the time. But the user still has not had the opportunity to install any application themselves. Of course, if you're listening to the podcast, it's more likely than not that you're running a rooted phone by choice and you wanted to have it rooted. I have it rooted. Mm-hmm. But rooting a Samsung phone will immediately disable Knox. So, yeah, this is one way that Samsung has of providing this type of facility. And I know there are some firmwares that let you maintain Knox even if you root it, but let's not get into that.
Yeah, there's so many rabbit holes around this. And yeah, there's always a way around things and quirks and things.
Every time you hear me make this type of statement, like there is this way to do that. Assume there's a lot of other ways to avoid that and do it differently.
Right.
But those are the fringe cases, and we don't really want to focus on that. Android has some features. Android specifically, where they have this centralized key management system that you can use to store data from your applications. It is also cryptographically signed, and it also ensures that it has not been tampered with and all that. So there are some software features that help you achieve zero trust, and you should really look into this. And like I said before, Microsoft has actually been very active on this, and they have actually been pushing this for, I don't know, I remember seeing this type of options on their systems for about, 10 years, 12 years now, going back to Windows 2008 or something. Mm-hmm. Their identity management service, I believe it's called, had policies in place that could require the antivirus to be enabled and the firewall to be on. You couldn't connect to the network if you requested that. So, yeah, they have been doing a lot of good work on this front. So we're not just here bashing Microsoft and saying Linux is great just because there are some things they are doing great.
Yep.
Absolutely. Yeah. And on top of that, on top of all of these things that you can require, you should also look in this is especially useful if you have in-house applications that are developed for your own use and for your own teams. You should look into segregating application access, not by whole applications, but by features. A user shouldn't have access to the whole application feature if it doesn't really require so. If he only needs to get in and look at the report and download the report, he shouldn't be able to edit reports or add new ones or, I don't know, convert them to a different format or whatever, because it's not, the less you expose, the less risk you assume. So, yeah, that's a different way to look at authentication for the applications. It has to be done during the development stage, but it's also something that you should look into.
Yep, absolutely. And when you put this together, it just is the polar opposite of how things are normally done, how things are normally done is usually not good, right? Because there wouldn't be any problems if we were all doing it perfect. Yeah. But, It just seems so amazing to me that people set up their networks anywhere to just accept everything on the network. And this is the opposite of that, because you're not accepting anything that shows up unless you know that it's supposed to be there. And like we said earlier, there's always, other errata around that we won't get into. But by design, that's what it's supposed to do. Is it supposed to make sure that the IT personnel, they're on top of this, they know what's connecting, how healthy it is, and when to disrupt that connection if it doesn't meet the criteria in the policy.
Yeah, because as we have been seeing, I don't know, for the past few months, even more than usual, things break, and things break in unexpected ways. And if you have, for example, a specific network segment where you use to connect your web servers or whatever, and it's fine if you have 10 MTA IP addresses there because no one will be able to use them, you should be aware that there might be ways that you don't know about, and people might find a way into that network segment and might be able to plug their own web server there and disrupt your communications, for example. Don't assume that anything is inviolable just because that's how it's been so far. Come on, we've been seeing CVEs around everything. And the kitchen sink. So nothing is safe, and you shouldn't trust that they are just because they've been up to this point. Don't leave outstanding IP addresses open, for example. Don't leave them just because, I'm going to deploy a new system 2 weeks from now. I'm assigning the IPs so that they're available right now. Don't do that. That's 2 weeks that you leave them open for someone to try and use them.
Right.
You might not know about the way that they will try to use them, but there may be one that you're not aware of. So don't open yourself to the possibility.
Right. So that's, and don't have all your Ethernet ports turned on by default if you don't know if there's going to be something plugged into one of them. Just turn them all off and then enable them as you need them.
There is actually physical equipment that you can connect to the Ethernet ports that will verify that the devices that are plugged in there are the ones that are actually reaching the other side, so that nobody splices the cable and plugs in something in the middle. Yeah, that's actually something that exists. You can certify that the device on one end is the device that's reaching the communication on the other one, and there's nothing in between. There was this there was this nice presentation at one of the Black Hat conferences a few years ago where they were presenting a device, a homemade device, where they could splice a network cable without interrupting the communications at any point.
Wow.
They would insert it into this support that had these fork-like prongs sticking out so that they would pinch the cable, and they would be able to add new connections to those points and then break out a connector to use for their own use. It was amazing. No packet was lost during that operation.
That's almost Star Trek level.
Yeah, it was amazing to watch that. I don't recall the presentation name at this moment. I might look it up, because it really was impressive to see them doing that. They were making the presentation on a laptop connected through that cable. They never lost connection through it, and they were running pings or whatever, but the connection never dropped. They never dropped a single packet, and they spliced the cable. So that's the level of... that's how far this can go.
That's pretty far. Yeah. Really far.
Yeah. It's really amazing. It's the type of thing that blows your mind, and you never even consider that that can be a potential risk for your network. Who would think that the cable that's running inside a wall or under a fake ceiling or whatever can be spliced without you even noticing? And somebody just plugs in, say, for example, a Raspberry Pi. We keep blaming the Raspberry Pis for this. I don't know why.
But, yeah, comically Mr. Robot, I'm thinking.
Yeah, probably. But that's the type of things that can get plugged there and you won't even notice it. They hardly consume any power, so you won't notice it. They have wireless that's possible to connect there, so they can be spliced into the cable and transmitting that to the outside, and nobody is none the wiser. So, yeah.
I almost wonder in some companies if, you know, you go into the lunchroom, you're taking break, right? And you just want to grab a sandwich. And then there's this like little circuit board that's dangling from a hole that was drilled in the wall. And it's just blinking. And, oh, yeah, that thing is probably supposed to be there. And they just kind of walk away. Like, maybe someone should kind of not think that. I mean, because that's kind of the way a lot of people are, not trying to generalize anyone. But human nature sometimes is that we delete things that aren't important in our mind, even though they really are. Oh, yeah, that's supposed to be there. I'm hungry right now. So,
yeah, don't talk about it. Back in the days of the BBSs, this was in the early 90s, there was this story that was running around an AT&T office somewhere had this closet under some stairs, and there were networking cables running into the door, under the door. And nobody was supposed to be able to ask what was inside that room, and it was always locked. But it was a pirate BBS that was running there, and the ones that were using it know what it was. But no one could ask inside of AT&T what it was, and nobody knew there. So, yeah, I believe that 30 years past, nobody is going to get in trouble because of that. But, yeah, that was a story that that made the BBS post that back in the day about that.
It's always surprising how, gosh, it's so surprising to me how often it is that people don't notice new things on the network. Like, at the very least, you could have something like ARPWatch that kind of gives you you can't really always rely on that, but, you know, you can at least get that notification. I had a client one time early in my career where I didn't work on this myself, but a coworker did, and something went down, and there's a contract to keep everything up, right? That's what we did. So we couldn't figure out, like, there's something missing because it's down, and come to find out that someone set up a server on a desktop in a closet somewhere in the building. And it was very important, but nobody knew what it was and it wasn't documented. So it's just one of those things that's supposed to be running. And if it's not, then bad things happen, but no one, I mean, the person who implemented it probably left the company, didn't document anything. So, you know, everything is perfectly fine until like the hard drive dies. And it's like, nobody is like, oh, what's this box in the closet here that is turned on and blinking things? Maybe that's important, or what is that? But it took a long time before they figured out that that's why it was that they were having failures. I can't remember what the failures were, but it's just always surprising to me.
my experience was with the print server running on an Intel NUC device, which is also very small. It was dangling on a shelf, just connected by the network cable and the power adapter. But it wasn't even on the shelf. It had already fallen. It was just hanging by the wires. And it was in use, and it was a print server. And when it finally got disconnected, we noticed that printer stopped working somewhere.
Printer, that even talking about printers gives most veteran IT people anxiety, right? Like so many things that we're always constantly asked to fix a printer, but that's not technically what we went to school for because you know, they don't really teach that in college that I remember. And everyone expects you to know how to magically make the printer work, but even printer manufacturers probably don't even know how to make it work half the time.
And you know, the OS that's running on modern printers is another point of failure for these things. People will inherently trust them because they're just printers under them, but they're actually running software and applications on, under there. So they can compromise your network. And they even have hard disks that can store the data that gets exfiltrated from the network. And then the technician just shows up one day and removes the device because, oh, it needs maintenance, and takes it away and brings a replacement.
Oh, gosh. I remember with printers, there was like, it was so common pretty much all the time where to update the firmware, there's like an FTP server running on there. Yeah. And you actually throw the blob into that special FTP server that, you know, nobody changes the password on. And then the printer sees, oh, there's a blob here. I need to install that. And it just does it. And, you know, printers are one of those things that people will like keep running for like decades if they can, because they don't want to change it. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be a ton of these still out there today that have this FTP server on there that's just waiting for a blob to run, you know, to be injected into it.
Some will have Samba shares that accept documents that you upload to it for printing. So
they
will have this vulnerability that we talked about earlier. Yep. When was the last firmware available for those? I don't know, 10 years ago or something.
Probably 10 years ago. Yeah, most likely 10 years ago. So there's one aspect I kind of want to get your thoughts on about this, about the Zero Trust, because it's been increasingly apparent over the years that randomized MAC addresses are becoming more and more common. And I remember, I don't know if it was Apple, but they were in the news about this because apparently some store was... You know, when someone walks into a store and their phone is scanning for like Wi-Fi access points, that they kind of try to link that to track people where they're shopping and things. And then I think it was Apple that, I don't know if they were the first, they probably weren't, but just randomized the MAC address when it was negotiating for an IP address. I know some devices actually randomize the MAC address and, you know, that's what they present as, you know, for DHCP. So I wonder if this type of thing is going to make it a little harder for Zero Trust, because if the MAC address keeps changing, that almost seems to me like the admins will kind of have a lot of work.
But that's the thing there. You don't trust the MAC address to identify the device. You need some hardware thing running on the device that makes sure, that ensures and guarantees that device is what it's claiming to be. It's not just one single identifier that you trust. You'll have to trust the user using that phone or that device that's connecting to the network, and you need that device to attest that it's who it's claiming to be. And the MAC address is not one of the factors, because precisely of what you said, it can be randomized, it can be changed. It might be something like the CPU ID. A few years back, when Intel introduced the ID for their chips and the CPUs were... you could fingerprint the system by the CPU ID. Mm-hmm. People were up in arms because of it. But it was the predecessor of this type of things, a way to ensure that system was that system, because you couldn't tamper with that identifier. It came in the chip, and you couldn't change it. It's actually something that gets burned in during the chip production, and then they blow the fuses that allow it to be written so that it can never be changed after the fact. And it's that type of things that get done in production, then you can never change it again. You can read it, but you can never write it again. So that type of identifier, that's something that gets used for this type of security that we talked about, but not the MAC address and not other things like, I don't know, the SIM card number or anything like that. Those won't work either, because you can swap the SIM cards. Yeah, so like it has to be something that doesn't change.
Yep. And I think one of the reasons that made me think of this is because I just kind of, I don't know if this is how it normally goes, but I kind of think of things like, you know, a lot of companies, like they'll implement things one thing at a time. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just, you have this, this type of system like this, it has all these different layers. So you could implement the central user authentication system. So you have that. And then you could be requiring, second factor. So you have that, I mean, that's all good. But until you have every piece and you actually have a agent or some kind of piece of software that's negotiating whether to trust it, I do feel like even today, it's like most IT departments seem to be relying on the MAC address until they get to this point where they have something that's more tangible to trust. And that's got to be a lot harder nowadays before you get to the point where you're fully implementing this, to where maybe some people kind of are relying on the MAC address until they get their design graduated to the point where they're no longer relying on it. I think that's going to be a lot harder. I almost wonder if that alone can almost force this kind of thing, because you can't really rely on that anymore.
Yeah, but that's the idea. You end up forcing your users to only use those devices that provide that functionality. So you'll just don't let the other ones connect to your network. And then in the end, the users will have to swap anyway. It's a bit of a brute approach. It's rough, but that's one way to get things done.
That's true. They always say, like, or I think it was Steve Gibson that was saying in his podcast that there's the tyranny of the defaults. And then there's also, there's just things like this that you really got to pay attention to. And I'm trying to remember the other saying that was on that podcast. But anyway, that kind of goes in line with this, because you really do have to trust what's connecting to your network. And if you're not sure that you can, then you have to be ready for what could happen. And we see it in the news all the time. Like I mentioned, you know, companies that might have someone just bring a virus into work one day, you know, when they bring their laptop back to the office, and or worse, you know, there could be like data being exfiltrated from the company and then held for ransom or something like that.
Past months, for example. It's not even we don't even have to look back much further than that. In the past months, when we talked about the UKG group, for example, that had that ransomware attack. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was really nasty, and that could have had their information stolen at the same time that it was encrypted. So yeah, this is a real and present danger here. It's not just pie in the sky stuff.
Right. And the saying that I was trying to come up with is that convenience is the enemy of security. That was the one I was looking for, because it's often the case that, you know, people that are not in IT, they're doing things with a company that aren't IT related, and, you know, they just want to log in and do their job, and they just get upset. Oh, I got to go through this hoop and that hoop and that hoop. Sometimes it's just a matter of educating your people that, yeah, I know it's not like the quickest way to log in, but look, this is required. This is going to make your job more secure, because it's less likely our company is going to be the next Equifax. Because that's our goal, right? We don't want to outdo that. That's the metric. We don't want to be the next Equifax. We want to make sure we keep everything as safe as we possibly can.
Yeah, that's the new benchmark. It's Equifax for breaches and it's Log4j for vulnerabilities.
For holding down the enter key for a long time. I think I'm going to use that example like again and again, because that's just so hilarious. It's like the least technical hack ever. You know, anyone could just, I don't even care if you've even used a computer before in your entire life. You can hit
just press here.
Just press it a bunch of times and you're a hacker all of a sudden. Congratulations. All right.
We just scratched the surface here. There's lots more information out there. Just Google for Zero Trust Security Model. Most of the stuff that we talked about is present both in the wiki page and on some articles that will come up on that search. Mm-hmm. Do look this up. This is very interesting information if you're into cybersecurity. It's a different way to look at things. It's a more modern way of approaching security, and it does have benefits, not just trusting blindlink systems that are in your network, but actually requiring them to present themselves in a secure way to your other systems.
I mean, you don't just invite random people that are walking down the street into your house that you don't know. So why are people inviting random computers or just allowing any computer to connect to the network, right? I mean, it seems like it might be common sense, but at the same time, I also know that it could be hard to get to this point. if you haven't already designed your network with this in mind at the beginning, because that's always easy. If you just started a new business and you're like, this is how I'm going to do it. And it's just like that. And anyone who works for you, that's how it's always been. I mean, that's easy. But trying to go in and implement these types of things to a company that's existed for a while, that's always the challenge, I think.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely agree with you.
Just keep it, but definitely do it. Like, it's worth the battle. It's worth the fight. And maybe your users are more agreeable than others, but at the same time, it's a good thing to do. Definitely look into this and understand it. What might you implement it in your environment? Talk to your people at work about it. Try to, you know, get some buy-in if you can. And maybe it's something that you can explore. It's not going to be a project that you'll be done in 2 days. This is like a multi-step process to implement something like this. But I think at the end of it, you know, the additional security that you'll benefit from will definitely help out.
Yeah. Or if for no other reason, just look into it because it's a very interesting topic on cybersecurity. And who knows, maybe you'll actually see the benefits that you might be missing just from hearing us talking about it. And if you read about it, if you look into it deeper, you might go and realize the benefits that you'll get from it.
Yep, definitely agree. So that was our episode on Zero Trust Security. And I think maybe we might revisit this later on and point back to this episode if there's something building on top of that or even a solution that kind of helps that, helps achieve that. So there's definitely more to talk about. And like you said, we only just scratched the surface.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no way we can fit a tenth of this on a podcast episode. We're just here trying to get awareness to new concepts and all that. And then you have to do some legwork on your end and learn more about these type of things. We might revisit this in the future. But again, due to the format, we can't be here and explaining you how to do this step by step. If you're just listening to this on a podcast, it won't work. It's not the right format for this.
That's true. Yeah, because everyone's environment is going to be so different, like the types of servers they have, the type of workstations they have, operating system, software combinations, network settings, firewall settings. I mean, there's really no possible way you could walk someone through this. But it, like you said, they look into it, they can find out how to match it to their environment.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you guys for listening, watching on YouTube, however you're digesting this content. And we'll be back next week with the 19th episode.
Yep. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Bye.